How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunchberries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. He's John Littlefoot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last Crunchberry.
No!
No one steals my Crunchberries.
I think you mean my Crunchberries. Choose your own Crunch Venture with Cap'n Crunch.
Hey, and welcome to Talk Farm to Me. I am always glad you're here and so impressed with how you've been spreading the word about Talk Farm to Me and the amazing farmers who have been joining us here. Thank you. It's because of you that we have so many listeners coming back episode after episode. It makes me super happy, and the farmers have so much to share once you get them off the farm for a minute. Today's episode is no exception. Rick Clark has encyclopedic knowledge of soil and plants. He's a corn and soybean farmer and a cover crops expert. Let me just say this. We are going to get in the weeds with Rick. And I promise you are going to come out the other side of the cornfield with some seriously deep knowledge about how we grow corn and beans and how we as a country could do it better. Rick's experience in Indiana on a mere 7,000 acres is so rich, and his work has been transformative. From major chemical inputs to non-GMO, regenerative, and organic, we can unpack all of those buzzwords so you will really have a good handle on what they actually mean. You will be ready to impress your friends, win an argument, and to make some pretty powerful decisions about what you buy and eat or don't. So, get ready. Let's dive in with Rick Clark. I will be your guide. I think you're going to need me for this one. Fasten your seatbelt. Corn and soybeans have never been so inspiring.
I know you're a fifth generation farmer, and your family's been on your farm since, since
1870s, yeah.
Yeah, for a long time. I'm curious what you know about the farm way back when and you know, kind of how it started, what it was like.
I've talked to Dad about this a lot because Dad's the last one I've got to talk to about this. When I talk to Dad, and then you think back of what we're doing here, we're not doing anything new. What we're trying to do is remember everything we've forgotten. That's basically what we're trying to do here. Because so let me point this out. Let me lay this out a little better. When you think back to the way my ancestors used to farm, they took the farm, and first of all, they built fence, and they divided everything off into either 40 or 80 acre fields so they could graze their animals on the ground. Then what they did was they put their farm in a four crop rotation. It was a cereal grain, typically wheat, and then it would be corn, then soybeans, and then clover. And then the clover was mowed, baled, and put up in the summertime for the feed for the horses. And then in the fall, they would moldboard plow, which we don't do that now, but they would then moldboard plow the clover under, and that was the fuel then for the corn for next year.
The moldboard plow was invented by John Deere in 1837. It is an implement that cuts the soil, lifts it up with a curved plate, and turns it at least partly upside down as the machine passes across the field. This past year, on July 8, 2022, after 185 years, John Deere discontinued it, mainly because tillage practices have changed.
And they just rotated that across the farm. And then you think about what the Indians would do. They would drop three seeds in a mound and drop a fish in with it, and that was how they raised their crops. There was no monoculture here. So we're trying to do everything we can to maximize what Mother Nature has wanted us to do all these years with diversity and commingling. So that's kind of a quick background on the history. And my ancestors homesteaded in the 1870s. So we've been here a long time. And And I'm very proud of where we've taken the farm today. And I think my ancestors would be proud also. I believe they would.
So tell me a little bit about the gap between your ancestors and where you are now, because you're bringing that back. What happened in the middle?
We were some of the best tillers in the community. I mean, we kind of had these rules that if you did fall tillage in the fall and you could still see the corn stalk material, you didn't do it right. You have to go out and do it again. And so you did it again until there was nothing showing, but except this nice, beautiful black dirt that always seemed to move around, in the winter through either wind or water erosion, which we never really thought about. You know, we didn't think about fuel. We didn't think about how many trips across the field. We didn't think about this stuff. And one day, several years ago, we were doing the same thing we'd always done. We'd multiple tilled in the fall. We let it go in the fall. It would freeze in the winter. And then you come out of winter and spring. You're just itching to go. I mean, you're just dying to get in the field, You got to get in the field, And we're probably out a day or two or maybe a week or two too early. And we go out and we scratch the surface about an inch and a half, 2 inches deep, just trying to open it up and air it out and let Mother Nature's beautiful sun and try to warm this ground up and get it fit to be on. Okay. So we did this. Then you wait 3 or 4 hours and you do it again. And then you let it sit and you come back tomorrow and you plant corn, and it'll be the best planting you've ever planted in your life. Okay. So there's nothing out here bigger than a marble. All right. We've got the fields worked and the pulverized, and we do this normal thing one spring, and that night we get a 1-inch rain. I had no idea the rain was coming. Just 1-inch spring rain, you know how they just pop up out of nowhere. And all I can think about driving to the field that day is, man, I hope we can get in the field. I hope we can get in and plant this after. I hope it'll dry out where we can get in and plant. Well, I get to the field and the soil has washed from the field into the ditch and actually out onto the road. And this is a field that is 1% slope. I mean, you can barely tell that it's not flat. That's what 1% is. That's how little of a change it is. And I'm thinking to myself, whoa, this is where it all started for me, right here. It hit me just head on, right in the middle of the forehead. We have to make a change. So that's kind of the event that got my conservation stewardship, head in place. And when we got to start thinking about what's really going on here.
You're in charge of the farm at that point, and your dad's still around?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what kind of conversations did you guys have about that?
Yeah, Dad is one of those guys that I wish every farm kid could have, because Dad did not really teach me how to farm. He taught me how to think. And that's a huge difference, because when you step into this regenerative world that we're in, and we're in organic now, and we're doing all these things, we've taken almost all the inputs away, we've eliminated tillage, all these things, it's exactly the opposite of the way I was taught at Purdue University. And the way Dad taught me how he farmed. But what made it so much better was, not only did he teach me his way of farming, but he taught me how to think, which may seem silly, but when you are looking at a situation you've never been, it's never been brought to your attention before, you can think your way through the mechanisms on how to solve this problem. That's what he taught me how to do. And that's what's so important. And what I like to relate this to is, in 2022, just last year, I know this is going to sound crazy, I went through 38 plants. And you're going to say, this guy's a moron. This guy does not know what he's doing if it takes 38 plants to get through a season. Well, maybe that may be so. Maybe I don't know what I'm doing. But I think the real answer is, this is a living, breathing, dynamic system that's changing by the minute, and Mother Nature is constantly throwing curveballs and humbling you along the way, and you have to be able to bend and flex and adapt and be able to change in a moment's notice, and that's what I'm pretty good at doing.
So tell me a little bit about those plans. Like, what kind of plans do you put in place and how did they change?
Yeah, for example, I am very adamant about row spacing. So what I mean by that is we have a 20-inch row corn planter, and we usually plant our soybeans on 20-inch rows also, because I have a 70-30 rule, and the 70-30 rule is this: 70% of the weed suppression that is happening in our organic system is due to the cover crop.
A cover crop is any crop grown to cover the soil and may be incorporated into the soil later for enrichment. Popular cover crops include alfalfa, rye, clovers, buckwheat, vetch, and plants like that.
The other 30% of the suppression is due to the cash crop canopy. So the cash crop comes up, it grows, and it touches each other and canopies out the distance between the two rows of your cash crop. That's the canopy. That canopy stops sunlight, which then stops all life, okay? So we need to have the thatch, the mulch, the whatever you want to call the cover crop.
You're good on this now, right? When he says cash crop, he's talking about corn or soybeans, okay? Those are the crops he's selling for cash, and they contribute to weed suppression as they grow by providing shade in the form of a canopy. And the cover crop does the rest by covering the soil and making it harder for the weeds to take hold.
We're laying down, that armor has to be there long enough to get us to canopy. Okay, in 22, I've never had this happen before. We've been doing this a long time. We planted our cover crop in the fall of 21. It looked pretty good. I mean, nothing stood out to me like, you know, like thinking, oh, this isn't going to work. It all looked fine. We went into the winter, but two things happened. The first thing is we got a Canada clipper that came down in January or February. I think it was January. We did not have any snow cover, and we went to 30 to 40 below zero. That's not good. That's hard on cover crops. Okay, that's number one. Then number two, we came out of the spring and I thought, you know, we might have half a stand here. We might be okay. Well, then on April 28th, we got another frost. And that frost took out 90% of what survived that Canada clipper. So we are coming into the spring with no cover crop. And typically, we need a minimum of 8,000 pounds of biomass.
Very simply, biomass is renewable organic material that comes from plants and animals. It's the total quantity or weight of organisms in a given area or volume, and Rick knows just how much he needs to grow a successful cash crop. In this instance, he needs 8,000 pounds.
I've got less than two. So, all the grand plans were made in December. You know how it is. You're going to sit down and all your grand plans. Well, we're already throwing the first four out the window because I decided that we cannot take a chance and plant our beans on 20-inch row spacing because we'll never hold the weeds back with my 70-30 rule. There's no 70 to hold the weeds back from the cover crop. So I decided to pull the drill out, no-till air seed or whatever you want to call it, 7.5-inch spacing, and we jack the rate up to 270 to 280,000 soybeans per acre because I wanted the density of the soybeans to become the weed suppressor.
So more canopy and less cover.
Right. We're still trying to pull off the same thing. We're just flipping the role here. There is no cover crop to do the first part. We're going to have the beans do the first part. So it worked pretty good. The plan worked good. You could drive around the farm and you could tell, I can see some weeds coming, but it still looks pretty good. Well, then we hit 7 weeks with no rain and 92 degrees. And we are really starting to suffer. Now, everyone always asks me, did we hold up better than our neighbors did? Because that's one of the things that people want to attribute to a regenerative system is its resiliency, okay? And I'm going to answer it this way. our system is more resilient than our neighbors, but we can only go so long. 7 weeks with no rain and 92 degrees in the Midwest does not bode well for your cash crop expectancy here. So we had everything, and this probably helped. Everything went on hold. And what I mean by that is the beans have an ability to just hang out and just survive. Well, the weeds don't like this hot weather either, so nothing was really growing. So we were holding our own here. Okay, then we fell out of that mini drought or whatever you call that, a micro drought or something like that. And we started getting some timely rains. Well, here comes the foxtail now, because foxtail is a late season weed.
Foxtail is a highly invasive weed with a fuzzy top that actually looks like a fox's tail.
So now the beans have been damaged by all this heat. They've shrunk back. They haven't grown to what they normally should grow like, even though we're on 7.5-inch spacing. And here comes the sunlight through the canopy, and here comes the rain, and here comes the foxtail. And so we finished the year up with a pretty bad foxtail explosion. So that was kind of a long-winded story to tell you why I changed my plans. But through that time period, we probably changed the plan 5 times on just the bean crop, not including, you know, the corn or the wheat or the alfalfa or whatever else was going on. It's just a constant changing dynamic. And if you think that it's not, you're going to get fooled and you'll get buried, because Mother Nature will humble you whenever she possibly can. She's done it to me so many times.
I'm curious now, just to talk about cover crops a little bit. Back in your ancestors' day, you had the clover that was sitting there adding nitrogen to the soil that was fed to the horses and then tilled in. Help us all understand cover crops better and what role they're playing on your farm. And a little bit of weed suppression you've already talked about.
This is the way I look at cover crops. If you're going to take the effort to do your research and figure out what species you think would work the best in your situation, when you take the attention and the care to plant a cover crop cocktail, and a cocktail is a multiple plant species, okay? When you put together these multiple plant species, and these could cost upwards of $50 an acre. So the last thing I want to do is go out and terminate these cover crops on the first warm day of spring, which is what most people want to do, because they say, we can't let the cover crop get too big. We can't let it get out of control. What are we going to do with it? Blah, blah, blah. Well, I beg to differ. I want to go the other way. I want to take the cover crops to maturity. Okay. For example, cereal rye is a tremendous sequester of nutrients. If you look at a cereal rye at the 12-inch growth stage. So what you do is you measure a 2-foot by 2-foot square out in the middle of your field, and you clip everything off in this 2-foot square at the ground level. Ship it to your lab, ask them for a feed analysis, and they send you back the data. And now the reason why you're doing a 2-foot by 2-foot square is because you can calculate what percent of an acre that is. Then you can turn these numbers into pounds per acre, okay? At 12-inch rye on our farm, we are pulling in somewhere around 84 pounds of nitrogen in this 12-inch material. 84 pounds. And if we take the rye up to upwards of 40-inch tall rye, you're pulling in almost 140 pounds of nitrogen in this plant.
Nitrogen is essential for all living creatures. In plants, nitrogen is the nutrient required in the largest amounts. It is a major component of chlorophyll, which plants use to make energy from sunlight, water, and carbon dioxide. Remember photosynthesis? Yeah. It is also a major component for building proteins. Without proteins, plants die. So, super important.
So you see, what it's doing is it's going out, it's sequestering the organic carbon that's in the soil profile. Now, if you are a tiller of the soil and you are a high fertility user and a high chemistry user, you have no organic carbon. Well, I shouldn't say none, but you have very little organic carbon.
Organic carbon in soil is essential. When you increase soil organic carbon inputs, you increase crop yield. Higher soil organic carbon gives the soil greater physical stability and improves the level of oxygen in the soil. All of that leads to better water drainage and reduces the risk of erosion and nutrient leaching.
And then you come to our farm, where we've taken tillage away now for 15 years. We've taken chemistry away for 9 years. And you look at ours, we don't have hardly any inorganic nitrogen. It's all organic. This is good for many reasons. One, it's stable. That type of nitrogen will not be flushed out of your soil profile. You're only going to pull this off when you let the cover crops grow to their maturity. And that's what we do here. And if you want to mechanically terminate, so I don't know if you're familiar with a roller crimper, but a roller crimper is what we use to roll down cereal rye, certain legumes like certain clovers, hairy vetch, which is a legume, and a few other species.
Have you ever seen a roller crimper? It sounds like a hairstyling device. It is, however, an attachment for the front of a tractor, a long drum that's 30 inches in diameter with thick 3-inch blades and a wide chevron pattern that knock down the cover crop and crimp its stalks at 8-inch intervals. It's heavy and can be made even heavier by filling the drum with water if you need it.
And we can actually terminate those species with a roller crimper at the right time of their growing in season. And typically that is when you reach maturity. So that's why we take everything to maturity.
So when you do that roller crimper over all of this, it's just flattened out in your field.
Yep. So cereal rye, let's just stay there for a minute. So what we like to do, and this is what I call farming green, okay? This is when we plant a cash crop into a green growing cover crop. And we do not terminate until after we've planted. I learned this a long time ago. And this is what we do. So what we like to do on soybeans is plant into cereal rye at what's called boot stage. And that is a certain stage development of the plant of the cereal rye at its growth stage. And another way to say it would be flag leaf. At the very top, it'll put out a leaf that actually turns 90 degrees and kind of looks like a flag hanging out there. That's the flag leaf stage or boot stage. We want to plant our beans at this point. And I don't know if I described where I'm from accurately enough. I farm in West Central Indiana. I am straight east of Champaign, Illinois. And I'm right in line with the Iowa-Missouri border. So that kind of pulls me into where I'm at, right on the Illinois-Indiana line, okay? And for us, and it's not a date thing, it's a growth stage thing. But for us, boot stage is right around April 28th, somewhere in that last week of April, first week of May, okay? Then anthesis is when it's dropping pollen. And what's happening is the lignin is at the highest level in that stem of the cereal rye, and it makes it very brittle.
Are you tracking? Anthesis is when a plant is dropping pollen. Lignin is found in plants, particularly seeds, whole grains, and vegetables. The name derives from the Latin word for wood. So when it's high, the plant is most brittle.
So the roller crimper is coming along and just lays it down and it's flat. And now, Dana, we've got this mulch that we just laid down. It's a foot deep. So that's how we're suppressing the weeds. And that's how we're feeding the microbes from the bottom up now, because they are going to consume this cereal rye plant and turn it back into organic carbon, organic nitrogen, organic P and K.
P and K is phosphorus and potassium, which together with nitrogen amount to the main nutrients plants need to thrive. Phosphorus, the P, plays a crucial role in plant processes like photosynthesis, respiration, and energy storage and transfer. Potassium, the K, its benefits include increased root growth, improved drought tolerance, and enhanced photosynthesis.
And that's how I look at my definition of regenerative. We are regenerating the nutrients that are deep within the profile, pulling them back to the surface, letting them grow through a living plant, terminate the living plant without chemicals, and let that plant break down and release those nutrients back through the profile that now your cash crop can get a hold of. So it's just a beautiful thing. It's just we're just turning this into a cycle now. And we're trying to figure out how to maximize what that cover crop was intended to do for us.
I have a dumb question. So I've got my soybean plants and they're growing in the middle of this cereal rut. It's a machine that goes in and
rolls the rye
and leaves the beans.
Yeah.
So they're just sitting there and they're fine.
Yep. The beans will get knocked down with the rye and they'll stand back up. There's so many things happening here. The timing from boot stage to anthesis is about 40 days. And in 40 days, your soybean plant will be at V2.5 growth stage or less, okay? That's why the roller won't hurt. But if we wait very long past anthesis, the beans are going to get too tall. And then we're going to break branches off and we're going to shred leaves. We have to play within this window here. So what I always say is, if you're going to err toward any direction, err planting after boot stage, because you're in that 40-day window, which you now made narrower. You've given yourself more time, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Now I don't feel like that was a dumb question.
No,
that was a good
question. There's no dumb questions.
That was a good question.
You will knock the beans right down and they're going to stand right back up.
Amazing. Okay, I have another question. All right, yes. So you're putting down all of these nutrients with this rye right there next to your soybeans. Now, if you're not doing that, meaning you're using chemicals instead, tell me how that process works. What are you putting into the soil?
Yeah, so let's go back to before I was organic, okay? So we soil test. And I never really liked the traditional soil test because the extract they use is high acid and they're actually treating the soil as if it was dead. And I don't like that. So I go with the Haney soil health test and it treats the soil more like it's alive and it is giving you the amount of nutrients that are actually available due to the potential of mineralization, which the traditional tests do not account for. The traditional tests are only doing the calculation of removal of your crop that you're raising. So, you know, you got 200 bushel corn and it's times this divided by this and it equals 42 pounds of phosphorus was removed from that corn, whatever the number is. Okay, then that's how they make their calculation to come back and give you the recommendation for what you need to maintain your soil profile of whatever's in it.
Was that hard to follow? It's a lot of numbers and giving and taking, right? So let's just imagine your soil has zero nutrients. Somehow you grow corn, and when you harvest it, it measures 42 pounds of phosphorus. So that's the test, and the prescription for your soil is that it needs 42 pounds of phosphorus added back in. But what if your soil is not at zero to begin with? What Rick is saying is that the test does not take into account the nutrients in your soil to begin with. I just wanted to give you a minute to let that soak in. It's technical, but I think it's worth knowing. Discuss this over cocktails at your next gathering, okay?
Okay. Now, when we started realizing the power that these cover crops had, I decided, you know what? I am going to start eliminating these inputs. So what I did with my agronomist, I said, I want you to give us the total farm worksheet that you would recommend that we do on every field. I'm going to pick one field and we're going to cut your recommendation in half. Okay. And I want to see what happens if we cut what we're supposed to apply by half and let the cover crops take care of the rest because of what I just explained to you about the power of cereal rye. The sequestration power is unreal. So we then did this first field, took half away, raised the crop, soil tested again. Everything stayed the same. Did it again. Second year, took the half away again, took soil tests, no change. I said, we're done. I'm done putting down P or K fertilizer. I'm not doing it anymore, but we're going to do this two or three more times. So we took that field into year three and I took everything away. I brought 500 acres in and started on year one, cut in half, did the 500 acres year two, cut in half, no change. The whole farm now is coming in and we're taking everything away. And that's what we've done. Now, here's what I will say though. Dana, we are a data junkie farm. We collect data like you cannot believe because you can't make decisions, good decisions, unless you've got good data to help you make those decisions. I mean, so we collect data and we've got charts that show stability. And this is huge. So when you look at, say, 2010, and we started our journey before 2010, okay, but this is where the chart starts. When you look at a corn stability chart for our firm, and I don't know of anybody else that's ever done a stability chart like this. When you look at standard deviation and you're combining through the field, you're seeing swings of 40 bushel driving through the field. That's not very stable. But over time, as we were implementing our regenerative practices and we were 100% no-till, 100% cover crop, and we were now heading toward 70% reduction of inputs, we became almost a flat line, meaning we could pull into a field and drive through the field on a pass and shell corn and have 2 bushel of variance driving through the field. That is stability. And that also is what got me really thinking, again, the power of the two together, no-till and cover crop, because we've got a lot of farmers that are no-tillers, and we've got a lot of farmers that are cover croppers. But there's not a lot that are both no-till and cover crop because they're doing one or the other, or they're doing a combination of the two. Maybe some folks plant cover crops and then green manure with tillage to turn that cover crop down, and that's called green manuring, but you have to use tillage to do that. So we don't do that either.
Are you hearing the delineations here? Green manure is tilling cover crops into the soil, so the nutrients get in there. But when you till, you are disturbing the microbial communities there. And Rick is no longer about that. There are all kinds of levels of engagement in this game.
You have different variations of what regenerative looks like. And that's a wee bit of a problem for the future, I think.
Well, I think regenerative is certainly something that's been, you know, that now that word that you didn't have when you started, you know, looking at your farm, that word is being used and used and used. And I think it's been diluted to the point where when I talk to, you know, when I talk to different farmers, like, tell me, you say you're sustainable. Tell me what that means. You say you're regenerative. Tell me what that means, because defining it is so important. And I really appreciate your data. It's certainly one of my big questions is like, okay, well, how do you measure this stuff? How do you know you're regenerating the soil?
Yeah. I get to talk to a lot of people that make decisions, and I speak to a lot of people, and I'm going to tell you, I am fearful that regenerative is getting greenwashed out. And if we don't really make some serious headway with either a definition or a program, it's going to be moved on to the next fancy schmancy word. I mean, I never really liked sustainable, because you could look at any operation and say they're sustainable because they're profitable, they're making money, and they're here and they're doing it again next year. I mean, you could say that about anybody. You could say that about companies that pour pollutants into the rivers. I mean, they're sustainable. But now regenerative is a little better because it's at least getting down to defining something. But And I understand that we don't want to make a definition that creates a box that we can only live in, and then next week we think of something else, but it's not part of the original. I get that. I do. But we have to come up with something, because how do we know what goal we're all heading toward if we don't know what the goal is?
What do you suggest as a definition? Whose definition would it be? Is it our government? Is it you? Who is it?
I think there's too much impetus put on the farmer, okay? Why does the farmer have to do all this? Why can't we get the packagers and the shippers and all of the people? You've got the farmer over here and you got the consumer over here. Let's get everybody in the middle involved, get some skin in the game, and let's create a situation that produces a product that is healthier for humans to consume and is, and I don't know if regenerative is the right word, but we need to figure out how to get higher nutrient dense food to help break this massive medical problem we have. I mean, the amount of diabetes and autism and all of these autoimmune diseases, that's off the chart. But when you stop and look at how we eat, it's terrible.
Rick is a type 2 diabetic, and he knows how he got that way. He sees illnesses in his community and in his own family, and he knows that good health is as much about his own inputs as it is about the inputs that he talks about for his beans and his corn.
I've eaten candy bars, I've drank pop, I've done all of these things I'm not supposed to do.
And like with his crops, he's turned his own health around by applying better inputs. But he worries about everyone else, what they are consuming, and the farming system that produces it. He knows that doing better on the field is critical. And while he can't farm everyone's land or tell them how to do it, he has ideas.
I've got an idea on how I would do it. You want me to give you my idea?
Of course, please.
All right, here's what I would do. Let's first just look at the United States, okay? I would turn the U.S. into 9 regions, because the soil in Iowa is different than the soil is in New Mexico, and you cannot treat it the same way. So let's create, I think you could do this in 9 regions, and within that region, you have one elected mentor that's in charge of that region. That mentor then is surrounded by a group of his or her choosing to come up with the rules for regenerative farming in that region. I mean, the last thing Rick Clark should do is go to Mississippi and tell the people how to raise rice in Mississippi. I don't know how to raise rice. So why would I go down there and tell them how to do it? So that's a region. That's the Delta. That's a region of its own. That's one of my 9 regions. You then get these mentors surrounded by 6 or 7 or 8 people that create the rules of regenerative farming for that region. Then you have a body that oversees each of these mentors. I think that's all the more difficult this needs to be.
Let me ask this. We were talking for a second there about between you, the farmer, and me, the consumer. And yeah, there are all of these players there in the middle. Now, I know you have some history with companies and businesses who have come to you and said, my customers want non-GMO products. And that means if I'm going to feed my cows and milk them for non-GMO dairy, you know, for milk products, then I need to get corn from a farmer who can do that. Right. Now, so I think this is an important conversation to have, especially when we're talking to the consumers out there. We've got consumers who are listening, and they have power and they have a role.
Oh, yeah.
I want to talk about that chain, because there are a lot of very interesting players in there between me and you. And you've got your job and I've got mine. So, you know, how does all that work in your eyes?
Let's talk about a couple of things that first come to my mind. Think about what would make a shipper's life so much better to ship a perishable product like tomatoes. We're going to pick them green. because you can't damage, they don't bruise, they don't bust open and juice goes everywhere. So we're gonna pick them all green and then we're gonna ship them green. And then by the time they get to the stores or the shelves of the store, they're gonna just maybe be starting to turn ripe for the consumer to pick and take home and think they've got a nice, beautiful, fresh tomato. Now, did the nutrient density go down? Because I'm gonna guess yes, a little bit, because the fruit was picked before it was mature. Okay, that's one way I would look at that. So we got, again, this is where the shipper comes in. And I'm telling you, this is only being done because the shipper is demanding this, okay? Now let's go to oats. I love talking about this one. This one will blow your mind. I am getting ready to talk somewhere in Iowa, I think, and there's this wonderful professor, and he is talking about the amount of glyphosate that is in food that we eat.
Glyphosate. You probably know it better as Roundup. It's a weed killer. It has been linked to cancer in numerous research studies and is the defendant in multiple lawsuits. Glyphosate is a bad word. You should know it. Tuck it away.
Okay. What do you think number one on his list was? It was oats. And I'm sitting back here and I'm a farmer and I know these things and I'm thinking, oats. Now, why in the world would oats be number one? Oats are not genetically modified. Do you know, Dana, do you know how many things in the world are genetically modified? You know?
Not many.
10.
Yeah.
That's it.
Like soybeans, right?
Yep. Soybeans, corn, sugar beets. I forget. Canola, maybe. But anyway, I forget. There's 10 of them.
Here's the GMO list. Soybeans, corn, both field and sweet corn, canola, cotton, alfalfa, sugar beet, summer squash, papaya, apples, and potatoes.
And we freak out, like every single label, non-GMO, GMO,
yeah.
Non-GMO,
yeah.
On 10 items.
That's good marketing. So like go to the farmer's market and you buy that box of blueberries that says non-GMO on it. Well, folks, all blueberries are non-GMO. There are no GMO blueberries. That's just good marketing. So number one on his list is oats. I'm thinking, how? Oats are not genetically modified, so you would have no reason to spray Roundup on oats, right? So I got to raise my hand. In the middle of his presentation, I say, Bob, I'm sorry, but you've lost me here. You have to tell me, why are oats number one on your list of food with glyphosate in it? And he said, Rick, it's real simple. It's all about the timing of the combines to be there to harvest the oats. See, this is not about the farmer. So the farmer has done his part. They have raised the crop. They've done everything they're supposed to do. And so now it is told to them in their contract that they have to spray to desiccate. This is the term, desiccate. So they are prematurely terminating the oats. So guess what? The combine's going to be here next Tuesday, and those oats have to be mature because he's coming to harvest. That's what's going in little Billy and little Sue's oatmeal. That's insane. And this has nothing to do with the farmer and what the farmer wants to do. This is all about the people in the middle making it easier to get that product to the processing plant. That's what that's all about.
So just to clarify, right, when I'm spraying my oats crop with glyphosate, it dries the plant. It kills the plant immediately, and then it can be harvested.
Yep.
I just think that consumers have absolutely no idea, and they've heard of the lawsuits with Roundup, and they've heard that it causes cancer, and how do you know if it's in your food or not?
That day is coming, Dana, where we're going to be able to test this with our phone. We will. It's coming. But, you know, what I try, and there are so many good farming operations around the world that truly care about what we're doing for human health, okay? So my recommendation is to people, first of all, organic is better than the alternative, okay? But not all organic is good. But organic is better than just buying an apple from the shelf over here. If you can afford it, always buy the organic apple versus the non-organic apple. I mean, my God, apples, the amount of spray that gets sprayed on them is unbelievable. I tell you, Mother Nature, she has absolutely guided me on where I'm supposed to be going. And thank God I paid attention to the signs that she was giving me, and I took advantage of them. And that was one of them, was going organic. I think right now, Dana, I think there's so many things that need to change. I think sometimes the mindset is we have to hit a home run or we're not going to, it's either a home run or nothing. And I don't think that's the right way to look at it. A lot of little singles add up to a lot of good things. So let's do a lot of little singles along the way.
Let's talk about this single. What if you demonstrate with money, in addition to the stability charts, all that hard work that Rick has done, and it is such hard work day in and day out, and all that data. What about the money? Let's just talk inputs, because as a commodity farmer, you can control that.
What are the expenses for synthetic inputs versus the seeds for the cover crops?
Yeah, I think right now, if you were to raise an acre of corn with full inputs, chemistry, fertility, I think it's around $800 an acre, $850. And you could put out a $50 cocktail of species to do the same thing.
Do you have a hard time getting people to believe you, to believe that?
I do until I show my data, because I'm living it. I'm in the game with them, and I'm trying to show them that you can do this. I so much believe in our system that we are now heading into year 5 of no crop insurance, no government subsidy payments, no government programs, nothing. I am getting money because, see, people want to say that, well, Rick's just relying on the government check. No, because look, I do not want to be a hypocrite. You got to do this, you got to do this, you got to take it all away, and then I'm going to stand here with my hand out. Okay, government, where's my subsidy payment because my corn crop didn't do what I thought it should do? No, I don't roll like that. So no insurance, no government subsidy payments, no one out there is subsidizing Rick's farm, nobody. So again, are you going to reach everybody? No, you're not.
Singles.
Yes.
We need a bunch of singles.
Single score runs too.
Wow. I have never spent so much time in a soybean field, have you? And the things that you can learn there, astonishing. I mean, you look out across those green acres and you think, oh, it looks so simple. Well, now you know it's anything but simple. And knowing what you know now makes your job harder as a consumer. But you have the power to demand change one grocery shopping trip at a time. This is Talk Farm to Me, where you find honest conversations with serious farmers. Your job is simple. Be here. Hear them. Know that they are out there getting important work done on our land for our benefit. And some farmers, like Rick Clark, are making it more challenging for themselves as they pioneer their way back to a healthier, better way of farming for themselves, for us, and for the land. Find Rick and more information about what he's up to at farmgreen.land. I am pretty sure he's not done yet. As a matter of fact, Rick and I talked forever, and I'm really mulling over the idea of bringing you two minisodes on parts of our conversation that had to do with carbon credits, what to do and what not to do, and organic farming, Rick's hot take that will blow your mind, did mine at least. So, if you're good, I will share. Stay tuned. Thanks for being here. If you found this interesting, share it with a friend. That's exactly how it's gotten so many listeners so far, from you sharing it, one episode at a time. Coming soon, in addition to some minisodes with Rick, irresistible walnuts, beef, and, well, Temple Grandin.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. It's John Lefoot.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away!
Throw our last crunch berry!
No!
No one steals my crunch berries!
I think you mean my crunch berries.
Choose your own Crunch Venture with Cap'n Crunch.